Thank you, Martin, and thank you everyone for coming. Because I say that because, as you may or may not realize, Hungarian wines, particularly Hungarian dry white wines and dry wines in general, are not very well known outside of Hungary. I mean, I don't know how often you come across them, but when I travel abroad, I don't see them too often. So it's kind of been my mission for the last 10 years to try to take the story that we know in Hungary about our wines abroad. So I'm a Canadian-Hungarian, born in Canada, but all my family is Hungarian. I grew up on a farm, not vineyards, but a tobacco farm. But in any case, the aromas of tobacco filled my nose as a kid. Now it's the wine and that's filling my nose with beautiful aromas. There are some similarities, lots of differences, but my love for the land is the same all around. And so after many years of working as an architect and it's another business line, I moved into winemaking about 10 years ago. I'm partnering in another winery also within this region that we're in. And then I started my own winery in 2012. I point to this picture, and I hope you can see it well enough. It's an absolutely stunning region. It has a mysticism that I think even, I don't know if you know the name Roland Velik of Moritz. He's a friend of mine, a winemaker from Austria, and he arrived one day, and he said he arrived in Jurassic Park. Because it has this timeless and ageless nature to it. They're volcanic buttes that have been around for about 8 to 4 million years. We'll get into that more a little later. But the fact is that around all these little mountains, we have vineyards. And they've been grown at least since Roman times. And I think that you'll see as I delve into the terroir, the reason I want to talk about this so much is that it's so little known. In fact, this is absolutely undiscovered, I think, in large part throughout Europe, in Hungary, or sorry, in the UK as well, very little known, but it has a long and deep and wonderful history. So to put it in perspective, in terms of volcanic wine regions, and I think maybe you have touched and you've felt, maybe from press, volcanic wines have become a bit of a trending type of wine. John Subbo, a friend of mine, also Master Sommelier, wrote the book Volcanic Wines. He basically draws out the kind of scope and spectrum of not all volcanic regions, but many of them, including these, and it kind of puts in perspective where our region is. It's the Badachan appellation. It's quite a small appellation, but if you look at the timeline, it goes back from 50 million years to Soave, where there's you know, it's volcanic and then also has a non-volcanic region, but a volcanic region, through to Oregon and Tokaj, being Hungary, maybe less known to many people. That is a volcanic region. And much of Hungary's northern wine regions are all volcanic. And I think you'll see that if you taste across Hungarian white wines, particularly the higher quality ones, the nature of the volcanic, good acidity, good complexity, freshness that you'll get from Hungarian white wines. And then, of course, our region, which literally exploded onto the scene 3 to 4, starting at 8 million years, but finishing around 3 to 4 million years ago. Of course, we know that Sicily is still active, and you really see the difference in the terroirs between all of these regions because it's the level of decay or erosion of all these and the tectonic movements, you'll see a big difference. I mean, you'll go to Santorini or Sicily, and it's black, the soil, of course. We have black stone, but it's much more integrated with other material, and we'll talk about that in 1 minute, about how our mountains came to exist. So to get specific about our mountains, and this is Mount St. George, but there are about 7 in our region, in our appellation. And on every one of them, there's grapes to some extent. This is one of the bigger ones. It was a Stromboli type of explosion or eruption. So Stromboli meaning it's blasted out of water. So there was a huge pan and sea across the Carpathian Basin, ancient sea. It was relatively shallow and brackish. And what it means is that when it explodes, it has a lot of steam and it's violent. And what happens is that tuff is formed. It's a kind of a porous, bubbly-looking rock, and it forms a ring. And then within that ring, the magma and the lava was created, and it formed a lava lake. So I talk about this because it gives the formation to our shapes of our mountains. Many of them are quite flat-topped, because once the erosion started, this lava lake became exposed. And we have, and you'll see on your brochure, a beautiful picture of basaltic pillars, which is a quite interesting geological formation, which over the eons have eroded down into the skirts around the mountain. And this was mixed with the sea sediment, which was created by erosive action, a lot of wind erosive action. And it left us with very terroir around these buttes. So between clay and stone, between sand and stone, between loess and stone, around the mountain, depending on how water flows happened, about how the wind on different sides of the mountain created and deposited this together. So it's millions of years of microelements all mixed together in a beautiful melange, which the sea sediment gives us a water retention ability, so we can have healthy vines without irrigating, so there's no irrigation in our region. And that's basically gives form to what we have today, this kind of flat top. Actually, the locals call this the water buffalo mountain, as you can see there. The sleeping water buffalo.
There are very few volcanic vineyard areas in the world, I believe, really.
Relatively few, yeah.
Relatively few. What does the volcanic soil add to the wine? Why is it, what was its distinctive properties?
Well, I think that because we do have some vineyards in the neighboring appellation, which is limestone, and I think that what John Subbo coined in his book very well is a very vibrating acidity, an acidity that's very direct and long in many cases, and I think you can see this across most volcanic regions. I think you get a bit of this saltiness, definitely a salty.
It's umami.
And umami as well. So particularly as it ages the wines, the umami comes forward. It's quite beautiful and excellent pairing with foods, because the acidities are very present, and then really nice to pair with all sorts of foods. I think that's what we can say there. I mean, volcanic soils are so different around the world. It is John's challenge, and he's continuing to research beyond his first book into really at a molecular level to show how volcanic wines are different than other wines. And I think his next book is on that topic. It'd be very interesting to see what he's come up with. But he's published a few articles already about what he's going to be doing.
So the essential USP, in fact, is this umami flavor, isn't it?
Really? Yeah,
this
exactly.
Intensity. Perhaps we could start tasting.
Yep.
The
first wine you have is a cuvée. So this is a volcanic and dolomitic limestone cuvée. So as I mentioned, we have some vineyards that are in dolomitic limestone. It's a blend of Olas Riesling. So if I talk about varietals now for a moment, our main varietals at our cellar are Olas Riesling, which is Riesling Italico or Welsh Riesling. It's many names in Central Europe. The second would be Rhine Riesling. Rhine Riesling, everyone knowing where that comes from. Some Pinot Gris and Sauvignon Blanc. It's a majority volcanic wine in terms of the varietals. So the only non-volcanic varietal in here is the Olas Riesling. But I think you can feel in this as well that nice saltiness on the finish, a good acidity, and freshness and a bit of citrus, usually on the nose. Ages quite nicely. And then we'll approach the next wine after I move on to the next slide.
And the next wine is the Riesling, isn't it?
No, the next wine is a Sauvignon Blanc.
Okay.
So, while you're just tasting that and making your notes, let me just add a few things about our region. So many people know about Tokaj and the grand history of Tokaj. I mean, Tokaj was the first appellation system in Europe before France. But Hungary was always a wine country, largely from the time of the Romans. But after that, because of successive waves of immigration, either coming from the south, from Serbia and through Turkey and the Balkans, or from the waves of immigrants from Germany bringing things like Riesling and their technology and know-how in making wines. But this is a picture of circa 1930 of the mountain. It's a beautiful picture. If you can get it online and see it very in detail, it's a beautiful plate showing that shape. And the wines of this region actually did reach foreign borders, largely after the Napoleonic Wars, where they were probably discovered by many invading and warring forces. And then through the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they were distributed, reaching Trieste, London, across Europe through a merchant system based out of a town right next door to us, where they have 6 kilometers of cellars under the city, massive cellars. And so these had a great and wonderful export from this region, much bigger than we have today, much, much bigger, which is quite astounding to me to know how they worked in that time. Before the last slide, maybe just you may be on your second wine, which is a Sauvignon Blanc. I'll make a general statement about the varietals, why we have certain varietals that we do have. When I came to the mountain, I was primarily looking for the indigenous varietals. I think that's terroir is not only about the soil or the wind or the sun, or it's also about the culture, and we have a deep culture. Now, Sauvignon Blanc would be one of those varietals. You might say, where did that come from? Because that's a grand international varietal, definitely not a Hungarian varietal. But it does somehow weave in, because in the 1970s, even at the time when we had the cooperatives farming our soils, they would try to open to the West. And knowing the terroir, they selected Sauvignon Blanc to be one of the new varietals to plant. And I don't think they made a mistake, my opinion. They planted almost exclusively on the north side of the mountain. They also knew this. It's windier, a little bit cooler, and sandier on the north side. And it gives a particularly volcanic, salty Sauvignon Blanc, in my opinion. So somehow it does build in. It's a more modern culture of what we're doing, but they knew their terroir. And that always astounds me, even through that period where so much was lost during the Second World War, so much history, so many family legacies were lost. There were still people around that really understood their terroir, and they knew what to work on. And Rhine Riesling, the other one, being probably on our mountain, of all the mountains around us, we had the biggest plantings of Rhine Riesling. And you think Rhine Riesling is maybe not indigenous, but in Hungary, it's one of the older planted wines, probably from the 16th century, we know at least it was planted.
What sort of yields are you getting for the first two wines?
We're usually generally in the range from 4,000 to 6,000 kilograms per hectare. Those are our general yields. We don't push the yields, although our soils are quite healthy. We could probably push them further, but that's not our goal, of course. Our goal is to express terroir as best as possible.
So you tend to go for slightly, well, moderate yields.
Yes.
And obviously, therefore, a correspondingly higher quality.
Yes.
Or more intense.
Yes. I would say moderate yields. I don't believe in the extreme cutting back of the yields. I don't think that's not the way these plants were meant to grow. We don't need that. We can ripen our grapes as well. So we have a moderate yield, I would say.
And does the lake have a significant in terms of microclimate?
It has an effect in the amount of humidity in our region, which in general, you know, Central Europe has a fairly good humidity. It doesn't have too much effect. We're far enough away from the lake, probably about 6 kilometers, that the temperature effect of the lake is not too strong, and it's not a very deep lake, so it's not like a heat sink as much. One of our bigger mountains is right on the lake called Buttercin, where the appellation is from, and they do have an effect not because of the heat swing so much, but because they get a lot of reflected light off of the Balaton. And in some cases now, the southern slopes are a little bit too warm because they're reflected light. It was a very big advantage 100 years ago when they wanted to ripen and they had this reflected light. But now with the heating of our globe, it's changing quite a bit. Yeah? So lastly, about the terroir a little bit. So this is what it looks like today. The cellar is right here in the center of the mountain. It is a cellar from 1680. It was, if you know anything about Central European nobility, the Esterházys had very many properties. This is one of their properties they had. It's a relatively large working cellar they had. And that's where I found it in ruin. I renovated it. And you'll see on one of your maps where our vineyards are. But in general, if you see, Hungary has about 60,000 hectares of wine-growing territory. Our region has about 1,400 or so hectares in our Barachon appellation. And this mountain has about 200 hectare, a little bit under 200 hectare. We have 17 on this mountain. And I mean, today in Hungary, it is one of the really upcoming and rising regions, particularly because of the freshness and brightness of the wines that we're producing now, and the generational change we have with the younger winemakers coming on and having traveled the world or learned their winemaking techniques around the world. They're finding new expression for the wines.
I noticed that you say that you very often use natural yeast, sometimes selected yeast.
Yep.
And sometimes you seem to use both in the same wine. I find yeast very fascinating. I don't know, that sounds awfully boring, but can you tell us a bit about the effect of yeast and why you use selected sometimes and natural other times?
Yeah. The first two wines you're going to find are primarily directed fermentations or selected yeast. It has to do with who we're trying to reach with the wines in many cases. And if you understand the mechanics of and the economics of winemaking or wine selling, sometimes we need to reach people through the strata of our country. So we sell still about 70% of our wines in country, and our tastes in Hungary are not the same as the tastes abroad yet. And so the selected yeast have an effect of usually giving a profile, aroma profile that is more aromatic. And still, aromatic wines in Central Europe are very strong. We select these yeasts, though, to be the least aromatic yeast of what is out there. I mean, what's out there is can be quite dominating because we still want terroir to be the overriding factor. So in our entry wines, let's put it this way, we have more selected yeasts. As we move towards the single vineyards and the premium wines, they're all natural ferments and all natural yeasts. And because you're reading a more sophisticated crowd of tasters and drinkers.
So the natural yeast will give you a much more sort of signature feel.
Yes, more terroir feel.
Stamp, if you like, on the wines.
Absolutely. I think there definitely is a... If you talk about the top end of the wine tiers, I think you definitely have a quality increase. There's a vibrance, there's a multidimensionality to the wine that you get more out of the natural yeast. So we are organic, so we very much believe in husbandry of the soil and healthy soils. And that extends in the cellar, so to being very conscientious and low intervention in the cellar.
You say you have a unique terroir, and I believe that really, which makes it very individual, very special, doesn't it?
Yes, and that's why I try to make these presentations to actually impress upon people that it is different. And if you visit it, you will definitely have the stamp on you of what the terroir is like most terroir you travel to. And for people like you, it's important to give that message because it's going to be what you're going to remember of our wines, and that's not just. Not just another, I don't know,
another
yes. I mean, we must be able to express our terroir and our culture in our wines.
I can't resist asking. There's another volcanic region in Hungary, which is in the to the east, in the northern massif, I think, isn't there?
Yeah.
That's also volcanic. I don't know the ones up there, I'm ashamed to say. Are they very different from what you are doing?
The one you may be mentioning, which is a fairly large region, it's called the Matra.
Yeah.
It's next to Tokaj. So that, like I mentioned, the northern part of Hungary is largely volcanic regions, and Matra is a very large one, and their soils are much closer to the Tokaj soils.
Yeah.
Rhyolite and andesite are the main stones. Ours is basalt and tuff, dark stones. Theirs are much lighter volcanic stones.
It'll be more aromatic, weren't they? More...
Not necessarily, okay. No. I think the acidities are different. I think they have even more emphasized acidities. And if you see, now, and if you think of Tokaj, Tokaj's major grape varietal is Furmint, which we're going to be tasting. It's usually quite aromatic in Tokaj. It's also quite strong in acids, and they usually balance that with a little residual sugar. Where our acids, we can ferment dry, and you'll see that we have nice acidity in our Furmint, but it's dry as we get there.
And presumably, you, if I may say so, the sort of young generation of wine growers coming in from outside, you are employing all the modern techniques that the wine industry has available to you.
I would say, I'd say that we have them available to us, but we don't employ them all. In fact, less and less. So we do use cooled fermentations in our stainless steel. But less and less cooling. We find the expressions are better if we don't cool as much. We find the ferments are different, and we've liked the richness we're getting out of the ferments by not cooling the ferments so much. And like I say, in the cellar, low intervention, absolutely low intervention. So they are available, and we all know them. That's why wines become so, I think, uniform worldwide, because when the winemakers know so much about they apply the same techniques, and you get wines that become a little more like each other.
Yeah. Do you leave the wine on the lees?
Of course, yeah. We almost all our wines are left on the lees. We do very little malolactic fermentation, but in some cases, depending on the year and the wine, we will do some malolactics as well. If you start actually with this Riesling first, the fourth one,
okay.
That's the estate Riesling, and as I mentioned earlier, so on our mountain, Rhine Riesling is one of the biggest noble grapes that are planted. So some of the first vines that I actually purchased on the mountain, we have very old vines and we have younger vines that are about 7-8 years old. That's what you're having now. This is from a block on the south. East side of the mountain. If you're looking at your map, there's many blocks and many clones. We're using largely Giesenheim clones, but we also have clones from Slovenia and Hungary that are Rhine Riesling. And so this is a kind of it's a fresher, it's a more citrus, stony type of Rhine Riesling, and it's one of our bigger bottlings as well. And if we differentiate it to the Terra number one, Terra number one is a single vineyard, 100% spontaneous fermentation in stainless steel. It's part of a project we did, in fact. There is a Terra number two. As I mentioned, we have two different appellations. The one is the volcanic, as I mentioned, and the other dolomitic. In the dolomitic limestone area, we also have Rhine Riesling planted. In fact, we realized during the harvest, actually during the fermentation, what a good opportunity to do an experiment. And that was to compare the same clones, the same year planted, the same fermentation, the same bottling, everything the same, and do a real terroir examination. And we did do that, and that's where we can really highlight the difference between the volcanic and the limestone. In fact, I sent two of those bottles to John Subbo for his molecular test, so he'll have a real good sample for that. Yes, well, within one day. One day.
What's the acidity level of the Riesling?
The Riesling's around, I think, 5.6, around there. We have our sheets somewhere, but I think about 5.6 grams.
Is your industry, I mean, in other parts of Europe, the appellation controlée system controls winemaking pretty fiercely, really. Are your controls the same, or are they, in the sense you're perhaps a re-emerging wine industry?
Yeah.
Do you have slightly looser regulation?
I think we're not as, in terms of our appellation system, we are controlled. Quite clearly, there are basically three levels. And those levels are going to be reinforced now. In fact, our appellation system will probably change at some point. Well, we'll move to a village or mountain, as will be our top designation. And then probably Bulletin will be a one grand. Right now, as you can see on this, on the one map you have in your thing, the big map, we have several appellations around Lake Bulletin. Yeah. So to be less confusing and more market-oriented, we're going to move probably to the Bulletin as an appellation, with the village coming, or the mountain as the new system.
So will this be therefore these wines? Will this all be in the quality wine in the Shaggy Bull?
Yes, yes, these are all. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And how much of Plumbrian wine fits into that category in general?
That's a good question, and I don't have that number for you. That'd be interesting to know. But I think more and more, I don't know, so many people that come to Hungary and have the time to taste and eat in the restaurants and are always surprised that they're not finding these wines abroad. So yes, there's a lot of wines to be had, quality wines in Hungary.
I don't think you touched on the climate of your region.
Right. Officially sub-Mediterranean. But we're actually very similar in our latitude to Burgundy.
Okay, that's what I was looking
for. Yeah. So it's a bit more, generally it's a bit more colder, I would say, than Burgundy. It does have a bit of the continental effect. But I would say as the climate changes, it's getting more and more Mediterranean. I mean, we're having very light winters. So we don't have heavy frosts or heavy snows anymore. And I don't know where that's going to go. Of course, I feel very confident with our varietals. We have good acid backbone in our wines. We're able to harvest well and on time, and we can still retain our acidities in our.
Irrigate naturally, you said.
It's getting warmer. The whole region is getting warmer, as in the world. I mean, it's a big topic in the wine world, of course. As you're probably following the discussions. Some people are writing the dire notes on the wall that, 20 years from now, we all better be in red, because that's going to be the next phase. But I don't think it's that dire yet, but I've planted a couple of red varietals to see how that's going to come along. In fact, our mountain was, at least before phylloxera, 50% red. So it does have a history. Much different varietals than today, and they would have been drinking their wines much different than today. I think much higher acidity and very fresh wines they would have been drinking in the red wines in those days. But we have some beautiful Hungarian indigenous red varietals that we are experimenting with, so just hedging our bets.
I mean, global warming is a massive topic, isn't it, really?
Yes, yeah.
You spent a whole masterclass doing that, couldn't you, really?
Yeah.
Could I ask about oak aging?
Sorry, yes?
You oak age some of your wine.
Yes, yeah.
And I noticed from the notes that I've got that you use Hungarian oak.
Yeah, mostly Hungarian oak.
Does that impart a particular style? Or?
It depends on the cooper as well, but we use, it's Kadar, they're part of the Taranso group, actually. And they have their forests near Tokoi, the Zemplén forests. They're exported widely around the world now, those barrels. They do impart something that I think is particular, particularly the Kadar barrels. There's an apparent sweet note. So I did see some tests done, and the profile is one of the strongest in the sweet note area. So I see no sugar, but on the nose, a sweet note. Also, I find that there's quite a bit of spiciness coming from this wood. We do have some Stockinger as well, which we like very much. They're much more restrained, I'd say. Very elegant, as you probably know. So we do experiment with several coopers, but largely Kadar is what we're using. And we're using those almost exclusively on our single vineyards. And that the single vineyard you have there, well, actually the two Fourmates are both single vineyard wines. So is that we've talked, where are we at the Fourmates already? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
this is fermented.
Yes. Yeah. Some cases, 500 liter.
Okay.
Some years, depending on the harvest, we will ferment in, start the ferment in stainless steel and finish in wood.
Okay.
Yeah. 20 minutes? Okay, thank you. I think we're good.
Yep. Also do leaf stirring as well?
Very rarely. Sometimes, depending on the year as well. Depending on, you know, do we feel that we need a little more body and richness? But not too much. We let it sit pretty much quietly on its lees.
So 17?
17. So we're on the Vitality 17 now.
Yeah.
That was not stirred. No. That's just on the lees, about 9 months on the lees. So the story, as you may know, Fourmint is the big grape of Fourmint and Haschlever, the two grapes of Tokaj for the sweet wines. And you may or may not have run into some dry Fourmints already. They just had Fourmint February here and it was a nice display of Fourmints. And Fourmint has this ability to go the range, anywhere from Champagne. We are making a Champagne now of Fourmint, right through to the sweet wines. We don't want to make really sweet wines. That's not our goal. We don't think that our area has high botrytis pressure. I mean, in Tokaj, the reason why it's there is because they have a high botrytis pressure there, and that's where they have their beauty. But our dry wines, as I mentioned before, are fermented dry, rather than some residual sugar in there. I think you'll notice that in the barrel fermented Vatterdy. Basically there was not more than 1 hectare of Fourmint on our mountain when I arrived about 10 years ago. And I felt that we had to have it back there. It was there before phylloxera. We had to find the expression for our mountain. And we've learned much about growing Fourmint on our mountain in the last 10 years. And I think we're finding some nice expressions. And then the last Fourmint is a 30-day skin contact. This is a bit of an experiment, but in my opinion, a fortuitous experiment. I'm not overly convinced by all orange wines, but we did this. We actually made a pet nat out of part of this maceration. And then the rest of it went into barrel, and it was in barrel until last November, basically. And it's a very small bottling, but I think the expressions of tannins are quite delicate, and a little bit of higher volatile on it than the other wines. But somehow it gives this almost rustic, interesting expression to Fourmint, and I think we're going to continue it because we have a lot of interest in this.
What age are your barrels? Your age?
Anywhere from 5, 6, 7 years. Yeah.
And they've been used in Hungary, or do they come from other parts?
No, we bought them all new.
Yeah.
No, I much prefer. I mean, we have a nice balance now in our cellar, but. But we are experimenting with other vessels to micro-oxidize our wines, everything for maturing them, and we're having some nice successes with those as well.
What about growth? Is there much land you could still expand into vines?
Is there a possibility?
Yes, in other words? To expand your industry, in other words, or your region, your Appalachian.
Well, there's unfortunately, the trend is probably that there's going to be there won't be any more vines planted. They'll be replaced, but not more territory. In fact, the territory is relatively limited for the kind of the premier vineyards. And in some cases, a lot of the growers are not doing well. There are growers who are not reaching the market with their wines. They're actually selling their grapes. And there are large buyers of the grapes paying very little. So if we're expanding, it's because we're buying our neighbor, but not necessarily because territory is expanding.
So in other words, most of the vineyard land that could be planted is now planted. Is that
right? Yes, yeah. And some of it's has been left to go. Many of the vineyards have dilapidated. But now there's new people around, one of being ourselves, and it's making nice changes to the mountain. One nice thing about our mountain is we have a lot of organic or biodynamic growers. So one goal would be for us is if we can gather the forces around the mountain is basically make it an organic mountain. We're certified organic as of 2019 vintage. We started much before that, but it wasn't our goal to put it on the label. But we decided it's worthwhile to get the certification. So as of the next vintage, it'll be apparent on our label that it's an organic wine.
Well, look, everybody, keep one or two questions if you want. But I think otherwise we'll gradually wind this up now, and I want to say thank you so much to Robert.
Oh, thank you.
I did start saying I was being rather modest to myself. I didn't know much about Hungarian wine. Actually, nothing about Hungarian wine, I'm ashamed to say. But I've learned an awful lot today, and you've opened my eyes as to what there, and perhaps saying about something the future holds too, and you seem to be the future. So thank you so much for sharing your expertise. And I was saying to somebody earlier on, in my days when I was buying a lot of wine, I thought talking to growers was as important, if not more important, than tasting the wine. That, if you know what people are doing, what they're trying to do, what they're trying to achieve, that gives you a tremendous picture, and you give us a tremendous picture today, and you excited me anyway. So thank you very much, Robert.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Martin, and thank you, Davies, for this opportunity. So it's very nice.